Let us set aside the subject of video games to examine one last aspect of the autopilot effect in combat, the tendency to be literally scared speechless in combat. Speech is a fine motor skill, and the voice is one of the first places that you can observe stress in most people. This appears to happen as a result of the vasoconstriction effects of condition red, shutting down the fine motor control of the larynx. Remember on the Andy Griffith Show, when Deputy Barney Fife got excited. Remember how his voice sounded? That could be you. Unless you have been properly trained, it is quite easy for you to experience a profound breakdown of speaking ability. And in condition black, you may literally be scared speechless when operating at extreme levels of stress. One veteran police officer put it this way. I have heard the dispatch operator tell more than one overly excited officer in a pursuit to calm down because she could not understand what he was saying. When I was coaching rookies, I told them to take a calming breath before they spoke into the police radio. Whether they were about to call a car chase or were chasing somebody on foot, that breath almost always gave them a sense of calm, or at least a degree of control, so that the pitch of their voice wouldn't go through the ceiling and they could be understood. I also taught my young charges to use the siren as little as possible, because the sound of it elevates the heart rate and ultimately the pitch and pace of the voice. However, you can partially transcend these limitations through training. Like most fine motor skills, if you rehearse what to say ahead of time, there is an increased likelihood that the skill will be there for you at the moment of truth when you are operating in condition red. Police officers, for example, are taught to call out, "Police, drop the weapon, get down, get down." They train for this repetitively in a variety of training scenarios typical of what officers encounter on the street. It is because they train to use verbal commands in high-stress situations that they are able to employ them when needed. Officers did not always train this way. One veteran detective gave me this example. We didn't train giving verbal commands, so they weren't available to us during high-stress situations. One time, 20 years ago, a guy shoved a gun in my face. So I shoved a gun in his face and told him, "Arr, arr, arr." All that came out of my mouth was this weird, inarticulate, garbling sound. I was literally scared speechless. I asked him what he did then, and he said, "What could I do? I blew his stinking head off." Several officers have told me that they did not remember giving verbal commands during their fights or deadly force incidents, but were told afterwards that they did. One officer told me about a time when he was wrestling with a suspect armed with a knife. Afterwards, I told the other officers who were with me as we wrestled this guy down that I should have given him some verbal orders, but I guess I was just too busy staying alive. They laughed and said, "You never stopped shouting at him to drop the weapon throughout the fight. You never shut your mouth." Funny, I honestly don't remember doing it. Ken Murray, in his book Training at the Speed of Life, makes an excellent observation about training warriors to give verbal commands. He notes that we must program police officers to say, "Drop the weapon," rather than "drop the gun," since officers will often order role players to drop the gun during simulations when the role player is holding a knife or other form of non-firearm. If this kind of mistake happens in a real life-and-death situation, it can confuse the suspect, and it may result in the officer's judgment being called into question in court. By thinking through exactly what we want a warrior to do in combat and training him to say or do exactly the right thing in training, we can ensure that the right words and actions will be there when lives are on the line. Whatever you drill for ahead of time will be there for you in combat, no more, no less. If you drill for specific verbal commands, then you dramatically increase the likelihood that at the moment of truth, those commands will be available to you under stress. And if we drill our children on mass murder simulators, That too will be a reflexive, autopilot skill that is available to them at some tragic moment of truth. Chapter 3. A grab bag of effects. Visual clarity, slow motion time, temporary paralysis, dissociation, and intrusive thoughts. Trials dark on every hand, and we cannot understand. Charles Tindley, By and By. Visual clarity, a perfect image. You may see a muzzle flash, as if in stop action, or even see a bullet in the air. You may have a vivid image of the gun, or even a ring on the suspect's hand, but not remember the face. Artwell and Christensen, Deadly Force Encounters. Scientific research and volumes of anecdotal evidence indicate that in many shooting situations there is a sudden visual clarity, an incredible moment when the body dedicates all of its resources to get maximum value out of the eyes. You might get a clear picture of the details you ordinarily would not notice or remember. Dr. Artwell found that 72% of her survey group reported heightened visual clarity during their deadly force incident. My co-author, Lauren Christensen, tells of sleeping at home and being awakened suddenly at 2 a.m. to a terrible racket. He said it took a second for the fog in his head to clear, and when it did, he looked up into a man's face about a foot above his. A burglar climbing through the bedroom window, apparently too high or drunk to realize anyone was home. The man let out a small squeal when his eyes finally focused on Christensen's face, peering up at him, and he quickly scooted back out the window. Christensen leapt from his bed, grabbed his gun off the dresser, ran through the living room, and jerked open the back door. There was the burglar, a huge man, preparing to kick in the door. Christensen said, "The big ape was nuts or dumb, maybe both." When Christensen raised his gun, the burglar did have enough smarts to leap off the porch and bound through the shrubs like a spooked rhino. Christensen said that as he waited for 911 to answer, he remembers thinking that he had no description to give, since he had not made a conscious effort to note the man's hair color, age, height, and what he was wearing. When the operator answered, he first told her what had happened. Then she asked the dreaded question, "Could you describe him?" To his amazement, he could. "It just poured out of me," he said. "It was as if the creep were standing right there, and I was looking him up and down. I gave a complete, ultra-detailed description, none of which I consciously noted when I was about to shoot him. It was as if a perfect image had been ingrained in my mind's eye. Officers apprehended him about 10 minutes later." In their book, Deadly Force Encounters, Artwell and Christensen give another classic example. "I focused on the weapon pointed at my face from 12 feet away, and I could see the bullets in the cylinder of the revolver. I saw the suspect's forearm muscles and tendons tense as he squeezed the gun. I looked down the barrel and knew I was going to get shot somewhere between my nose and neck, probably my teeth. I fired one shot, and it struck the suspect. I couldn't believe I got off a shot before he did." Like many combat stress responses, the visual clarity effect can make it possible for the human body to do things that we previously would not have believed possible. This narrative from a sniper who has to shoot an armed suspect in a low-light situation pretty much says it all. I have heard of things like auditory exclusion and other dramatic things that happen to our senses under stress, but I experienced something I had no idea could occur. At the very instant I picked my aiming point on her head that night, a light turned on inside my scope. I'm not even sure how to properly explain this, but here it goes. It was like a light actually came on, not an illuminated reticle, more like an actual light. It simply got brighter in the scope, just like someone flipped on a switch. I have never seen the reticle more clearly and beautifully focused. It's my subconscious mind taking over control of my senses in order to put the emphasis exactly where it needs to be for this shot. My subconscious knew I didn't need particularly good hearing or taste to accomplish what was necessary. But I did need my eyes working at top form. So the unconscious mind takes over and does what is necessary for you to succeed. If this ever happens to you, you will probably recognize it right away. Be glad for it. It was a big help. Russ Klagen, After the Echo. Slow motion time. Time ambles. Time travels in diverse paces with diverse persons. I'll tell you who time ambles with all, who time trots with all, who time gallops with all, and who he stands still with all. Shakespeare, As You Like It. Perceiving the action in slow motion can definitely be a survival mechanism. Over the years, many people have talked about slow motion time, but until Dr. Artwall collected data showing that 65% of officers engaged in a gunfight experienced it, no one really understood that it was so prevalent. I have collected numerous case studies of officers who found slow motion time so powerful that they were able to see the bullets pass by them. On several occasions, they were able to validate what they perceived by pointing to where the rounds had hit. They were not implying that bullets move by them at a crawling pace, as when special effects are used in movies. What they meant was that the rounds pass by the same way that low-velocity paintballs or paint bullet rounds can be seen going past. Every case study gives us a little more information, a little better insight into what is happening. Notice in this case study from Warren Christensen's files how slow motion time combines with auditory exclusion to create a powerful effect. Officer Anderson stood over them, less than 4 feet away, pleading with the suspect to drop the knife. But the suspect had another plan. "You got 3 seconds, or I will kill this guy," he said, holding the hostage tightly against him. "I tried to grab the knife," Anderson says, "but he raised it in an arc above the hostage's head. When it reached its highest point, the hostage moved, just enough to expose the suspect's chest. All I could see was his chest and the knife. And then everything got quiet, and all movement slowed. I felt like I could stand back and consider options. What would happen if the hostage were slaughtered in front of me? What if the killer then dropped the knife and laughed at me? Did the hostage trust that I knew what to do? I knew I had to shoot or the hostage would die. For just a second, it seemed as if my whole life had been for this moment, a moment that was now and would never happen again. It was mine to decide." When the knife paused ever so briefly before its descent, Anderson fired. His first round demolished the suspect's wrist, and one of the other 5 rounds that followed punched through the center of the man's heart. His partner blasted the man with a shotgun. I remembered the smell of the gunpowder, but not the sound of my shots. I remembered the face of the hostage, but not his words. I remember the wail of sirens, but not who came. I remember my decision, but I don't remember pulling the trigger. Later, I told detectives I thought I had fired only twice. If I'd had 20 more rounds, I would have fired those 2. While slow motion time can be a survival mechanism, it frequently comes with too much baggage. It often happens in condition black and is accompanied by an extremely elevated heart rate and a loss of fine and complex motor control. Perhaps someday, we will be able to train elite warriors to make slow motion time kick in when they need it, without the additional complications. If there was a pill that caused slow motion time without the baggage, we could give it to baseball players so the batter could watch the ball creep toward them. Now that would be something. Until that day arrives, all we can say is that the slow motion time effect seems to be a random, unpredictable, and sometimes useful response to combat. For now, it is sufficient to warn our warriors that it might happen. Temporary paralysis. I couldn't move my legs. Anything you do can get you shot, including doing nothing. Clint Smith. 7% of the officers in Dr. Artwall's study experienced temporary paralysis in their gunfights. If this paralysis, sometimes referred to as freezing, were actually occurring, then we could say that it is a phenomenon that is clearly not a survival mechanism. Freezing does happen sometimes in combat, but in some cases we know that those who think they're experiencing temporary paralysis are actually experiencing slow motion time. A SWAT team member and law enforcement trainer in Wisconsin told me of an experience he had during one of his early entries. After they had tossed flashbangs into the house, they rushed in and began a search. As he moved around a corner, he abruptly came face to face with several armed men. All of a sudden, I couldn't move my legs, he said. I couldn't move my legs, and I didn't understand what was wrong with me. Why couldn't I move them? After a moment, he realized he could move his legs, just very slowly, he said. I realized that this is that slow motion time everyone has told me about. I've got all the time in the world. Is that a survival mechanism? In general, yes. The problem is that there are soldiers and police officers experiencing temporary paralysis and slow motion time during deadly encounters, but no one has warned them that it might happen. Suddenly, they cannot move their legs and they panic. They think they are paralyzed. Dr. Artwall talks about an interview she had with a police officer after he had been in a gunfight. The officer said, "The suspect shot at me, and I froze. It took an eternity for me to finally return fire at him." Well, it only seemed that long to the officer. There was an audio tape of the gunfight, and we know that the officer returned fire only a fraction of a second later. For him, though, it felt like forever. Dissociation and intrusive distracting thoughts. Chaos of thought and passion, all confused. Alexander Pope, Essay on Man. The following two narratives from deadly force encounters are good examples of the dissociation effect. During high threat situations, you may experience a strange sense of detachment, as if the event were a dream, or you were looking at yourself from outside your body. You may go from that "oh shit" moment with an intense awareness of fear to feeling almost nothing as you focus only on staying alive. Afterwards, when you snap back to reality, it will seem as if the event took place in the twilight zone. Even hours later, you may have difficulty accepting that it happened, as if some part of you is still in denial that it could really happen to you. I made a traffic stop on a man who turned out to be under the influence of cocaine. Everything moved in slow motion when I fired 3 shots, only 2 of which I remember. I was clearly out of body as I watched the shooting from above and ahead of my actual position. There was no sound from my .45 either, or any recoil. We are still at a very early stage in our understanding of these effects, and there could be no certainty as to precisely what they mean or imply about the individual who experiences any specific perceptual distortion. However, the initial conclusions from the 2001 stress studies of Green Berets, conducted by Morgan and Haslett, indicate that dissociation may be associated with less effective performance in combat and a predisposition to PTSD after combat. I believe that dissociation may well represent a powerful condition black response, indicative of extreme high levels of arousal that could indeed predispose someone toward a post-traumatic response. There is also data to indicate that dissociation and slow motion time often occur together in combat situations, which would indicate that slow motion time is also a condition black response that may predispose someone toward a post-traumatic response. The link between condition black and PTSD will be addressed in detail later in the book. The final perceptual distortion effect to be addressed in this chapter is the phenomenon of intrusive distracting thoughts. Dr. Artwell found that 26% of the officers in her survey, roughly one out of four, had thoughts that were truly intrusive and distracting during their shootings. Often the intrusive thoughts were bizarre, such as one officer who said that when a man shoved a gun in his face, his first thought was, "Wow, that's just like my partner's gun. I wonder where he got it." In the heat of battle, many warriors think of their family. One police officer said that during a gunfight, he had a vision of his 3-year-old boy toddling around in front of him in his pajamas. These intrusive thoughts are not always distracting. Sometimes they can serve as an inspiration or motivation, as in the case of one police officer in Arkansas who was shot in the face. He says that a sudden thought about his young son motivated him to get up and return fire, killing his assailant. Thoughts of a higher power are also common. This was exemplified by Bruce Siddle in his combat experience as related in his book, Sharpening the Warrior's Edge, and echoed by many warriors across the centuries. "God, get me out of this one, and I'll be there every Sunday from now on, I promise." Charles Rimsburg, in his excellent book, The Tactical Edge, trains warriors to develop positive self-talk, the most important of which is, "I will survive and keep going, no matter what." Often, wounded police officers report that this was all they heard in their minds after they were shot, and it was essential to their survival. These are the kind of intrusive thoughts that we must program into our minds if we are to survive in combat. Chapter 4, Memory Loss, Memory Distortions, and the Role of Videotaping. You are absolutely convinced it happened. Few of us can hold on to our real selves long enough to discover the real truths about ourselves and this whirling earth to which we cling. This is especially true of men in war. The great god Mars tries to blind us when we enter his realm, and when we leave, he gives us a generous cup of the waters of Lethe to drink. Glenn Gray, The Warriors. Memory loss. I had no memory at all of making that call. We have already learned of the blindness that the war god Mars can inflict upon men in combat. Now, let us examine the effects of the waters of Lethe, the waters of forgetfulness. Consider these two examples of memory loss from Dr. Artwell's files. An officer was involved in a shooting in which over 20 rounds were fired. Immediately afterwards, the officer couldn't remember for sure if she had fired at all. She remained unsure until an hour later when she and her lieutenant checked her weapon and counted the rounds. An officer shot a suspect twice with a shotgun to prevent him from entering a residence and taking a hostage. It was a righteous shooting, but the officer could only remember firing one of two rounds. The shooting review board found one round in policy and the second round out of policy. Their reasoning was that both rounds were justified, but since the officer couldn't remember one of them, it must have been out of policy. Nearly half of all law enforcement officers involved in deadly force encounters experience missing frames, that is, significant chunks of memory loss from their event. Artwell found that 47% of officers in a gunfight experienced memory loss of at least part of their actions. Interestingly, Dr. Dave Klinger's groundbreaking research, which will be covered later in this section, found that if you fire only one or two shots, you usually remember the number. But as you fire more rounds, there is an increasing tendency to forget how many you shot, or you underestimate the number. It is common for an officer to believe that he fired only a couple of rounds into the suspect, but then discover that he actually emptied his high-capacity magazine. Dr. Artwell says that memories of high-risk situations are often like a series of snapshots, some vivid, some blurry, and some even missing. It is common for there to be some degree of memory loss in a deadly encounter, especially when the heart rate reaches the realm of condition black. This is a phenomenon that Bruce Siddle and I termed critical incident amnesia in an article published in the Journal of the International Association of Law Enforcement Firearms Instructors in August 2001. This article is posted on my website, www.killology.com, for those who would like more detail on the subject. It is common within the first 24 hours to recall roughly 30% of the occurrence, 50% of it after 48 hours, and 75 to 95% after 72 to 100 hours. This is why it is so important for investigators to interview participants of a critical incident again after they have gotten one or more nights of quality sleep. Hartwall and Christensen give this classic example. I was in a high-speed pursuit with a bunch of other officers, chasing a known felon with a long history of violent behavior. When he started firing a gun at us out the window, I had the disturbing thought that I may not live through this. In spite of the fear, my training kicked in, and I performed well, and we killed the suspect before he killed us. When I finally got home, my wife made a comment about listening to the pursuit over the phone. I had no idea what she was talking about. It turns out that, during the pursuit, I had called her on the cellular phone in my patrol car to tell her I loved her in case I didn't make it. My wife said she told me to hang up and concentrate on my driving. I had no memory at all of making that call. Perseveration, trapped in an endless do loop. Insanity is repeating the same behavior, expecting different results. Anonymous. Why would shooters lose track of how many rounds they fired? Why would they underestimate the number? Let's take a look at perseveration, a phenomenon we first learned about from studying fires in crowded theaters and nightclubs in the early and mid-1900s. In many of these tragic incidents, people rushed to the door and hit the crash bar, but the door was locked. Now, after a couple of tries on the bar, a rational human being would go to another door. But these individuals were not rational. The midbrain had taken over, the one that operates like a puppy's. Now the puppy is in charge, barking at these terrified people to hit the bar again. So they did, trapped in an endless do loop, over and over until they died. Gary Klugowitz calls this tactical fixation. We fixate on the tactic we are doing and do not consider other possibilities. One police officer told me of a case in which he responded to a family fight call where a bare-chested man was running around the house in a rage, clutching a knife. When he saw the officer, he screamed, "You might as well shoot me because I'm going to kill you," and he began advancing. The officer fired two rounds into his chest, but the man only hesitated for a moment to look down at the holes. Then he began moving toward the officer again. Backpedaling, the officer rapidly fired round after round with his 9mm pistol. But like in a bad dream, the man kept advancing. At one point, the officer said, "I was against a wall trying to push this guy off me. I fired one more time." That round punched through the top of the man's head and exited out his neck. Finally, after being struck multiple times, he collapsed. This is probably a survival mechanism left over from our prehistoric ancestors. In those days, if a wolf was gnawing on your arm and you were smacking him with a rock, your best option was to keep hitting him as fast, as long, and as hard as you could until either you or the wolf got some relief. Even as you were wilting under the fangs of the beast, your last conscious act would be to smack that wolf one more time, because that might be the blow that saved your life. In such a situation, it was easy to enter into a repetitive do loop, with no sense of how many blows you had delivered. The problem is that we are not fighting wolves anymore. Today we use precision instruments in life and death engagements. At a distance of just a few feet, an eighth of an inch variance in the barrel of a weapon can make the difference between a hit and a miss. We need precision control. The rule is that you do not fire any faster than you can hit the target. Is there a tendency upon occasion for police officers to fire faster than they can hit? You better believe it. When in a life and death struggle, it is not uncommon for a police officer, soldier, or civilian to fire as fast as they can and as long as they can until the target goes away. Sometimes this is called the spray and pray response. Earlier, I mentioned the tragic Amadou Diallo shooting, where four NYPD officers fired 41 shots at point-blank range into an unarmed man. It was shown after the shooting that the average officer could empty a high-capacity 15-round 9mm magazine in 4 seconds. So does such a magazine give you the ability to blaze more ammo downrange? Upon occasion, sure. And you can empty the magazine in 4 seconds. The problem is that unless you are firing at point-blank range, the average shooter cannot hit a barn door at that rate of fire. And even if you hit the bad guy with all 15 rounds in 4 seconds, it is highly unlikely that he can die that fast. Imagine him saying, "I'm gonna fall, but you gotta give me a second here." The problem is that we now have a capacity to achieve incredible overkill in a spray and pray of vast numbers of bullets fired. Then, of course, the next day the press screams, "Alleged suspect killed in hail of police bullets." It is a problem nationwide in law enforcement. Later in this section, an entire chapter will be dedicated to Dr. Dave Klinger's superb National Institute of Justice, NIJ, study of 113 police shootings. At this point, however, I want to note a portion of his study that provides a powerful insight into this perseveration effect. In a table drawn from Dr. Klinger's NIJ report, which is available on the PDF included with this audiobook, we see that as the number of shots fired goes up, the ability to recall how many were fired goes down. You could conclude from this simply that the more shots fired, the harder it is to remember, with equal chance of over or underestimating. But Dr. Klinger also reported the fact that, in 21 cases, the officers thought they had fired fewer rounds, while 9 officers had no idea how many rounds they fired. The more rounds fired, the more likely this was to occur. Only 4 individuals thought they had fired more rounds than they actually did. A training sergeant from one major western city told me that his city had been having a significant problem with officers firing far too many shots with drastically low hit ratios. He said that on the firing range, his officers could get around 90% hits, but on the street, they were lucky to hit with 20% of the bullets fired. When the sergeant was ordered to call major police departments around the country to see if others were having the same problem, he found that the vast majority of departments were. One agency called it the Metro Spray. He also found that a small minority of departments had fixed the problem and were getting over a 90% hit ratio in real life-and-death shooting events. The California Highway Patrol, Salt Lake City PD, Toledo PD, and other pioneers across America are now reporting extraordinary hit rates while firing very few rounds. One of the key distinguishing characteristics that differentiates these departments from others is their training. In particular, in-service training that provides stress inoculation with paint bullets or some other kind of force-on-force training with marking capsules. There is solid evidence to believe that the problem of multiple shots with few hits is partly the result of a fear-induced stress response. The solution, therefore, is to inoculate against the stressor to prevent or reduce the fear. Force-on-force training with paint bullets or paintballs does exactly that. Sam Faulkner at the Ohio Peace Officers Training Academy has an extensive program using simulated gunfights with paintball guns and waterball capsules that he calls his shot avoidance course. After training one major Ohio police department, their hit ratios were so high and the fire was so deadly that, in Faulkner's words, the department's training sergeant was called in after a complaint was made to the chief by some departmental captains. They said in previous years, their officers involved in gunfights had either missed or wounded the perpetrators. That year, there were 6 gun battles. Each was within departmental policy and in compliance with Tennessee v. Gardner, the case law standards on legal shooting. Your question, then, is what is their problem? The problem is that in all of the 6 gunfights that year, the officers had killed the subjects, and the captains were afraid that the training sergeant was turning their troops into trained killers. The sergeant was upset by this and gave me a call. I explained my take on the situation this way. Can we teach our officers to shoot too well? I don't think so. If we trained our officers in first aid and everyone they treated survived, did we train them too well? If we trained our officers in driving and they never had any more accidents, did we train them too well? If someone must die in an armed encounter, let it be the subject who is initiating the hostile action and not another officer. Paint bullet training and stress inoculation. It is to the warrior what the flame house is to the firefighter. Awareness is good, but without skills and ability tied to that awareness, all you have is anxiety. Tony Blauer, extreme close quarters combat trainer. I should make it clear that the most common brand of paint bullets is the Simunition brand, which has become commonly used to refer to any gunpowder-propelled paint bullet marking capsules, just as Kleenex or Xerox are brand names which have become generic terms for a product. Ken Murray, in Training at the Speed of Life, his definitive book on force-on-force simulations training, warns against referring to paint bullet training as simunition training, since the Simunition brand name also makes frangible ammunition and other types of ammo that is quite deadly if accidentally used in force-on-force training. Murray points out that this is like Tylenol making their product, but also making rat poison with the Tylenol brand name on it. I am not endorsing the Simunition brand, but I am endorsing the training concept, which has been pioneered by this one corporation. Other useful tools for force-on-force training included very realistic purpose-built military and law enforcement trainers, which fire paintballs and water balls, such as the line of products manufactured by GunFX Tactical Development. Because of the vast array of excellent products and systems available, this audiobook could not possibly list them all. There is, however, a thorough discussion of the various training systems, products, protective equipment, and the essential training philosophies necessary to extract the optimal training value in a safe manner in Ken Murray's Training at the Speed of Life. Many elite military and law enforcement organizations have applied this type of training with remarkable success. Sometimes we see SWAT teams and special ops units whose members think they are good, but they get a rude surprise during their first force-on-force scenario using paint bullets. But then they get better, much better. One of Gavin DeBecker's trainers clearly articulated the value of this training when DeBecker's elite team of world-class bodyguards trained with Simunition brand paint bullets. Prior to each student going through the scenario, I noticed that they were very calm. However, once the training began, we could tell that the stress level was higher, either due to anticipation of what was about to take place or because of the realism of the scenario. Realism meaning, most people, in my opinion, military or not, rarely point or get a real weapon pointed at them where they know something is going to come out and hurt them or the individual. In the military, most soldiers use blanks where they know no one will get hurt. In simunition, we use our personal weapon, the same exact weapon we are going to use to protect our principal, our family, and even ourselves. We know it will kill an individual, and we know it will kill us, So when one of the students actually picks it up, points it at someone, I notice how much they hesitate to pull the trigger when their stress level is heightened and their muscle memory tells them that this is a real gun, that something is going to come out and someone is going to get hurt. I mention this because I think it is one of our beginner class benefits. I believe it will save them if a situation ever arises and they have to use their weapon to defend their principal or themselves. What I believe to be the most important lesson is that you are not dead until you are dead. During training, a few agents would die after being shot or after feeling the pain of the round. We would tell them that they are not dead until they are dead. Simunition training allows us to train them to continue on after they are shot and after feeling the pain from the round. I believe the pain from the simunition round instills a muscle memory that is beneficial, because if they are ever in a situation where they are shot at and they feel some pain, they will continue on to safety instead of stopping to see if the pain they feel is indeed a gunshot wound. There is a powerful obligation to participate in this type of realistic training. There are many officers who do not want to participate in paint bullet training for fear of having to lay their training skills on the line in front of their peers, fear of feeling the sting of a round impact their skin, and a general fear of having to function outside of their comfort zone. Yes, these factors do exist in this valuable realistic training, but they also exist in a real gun battle. Let's say there is a group of firefighters who have been going into dangerous fires and responding inappropriately. We discover by looking at their training records that these firefighters have never practiced in a real flame house training environment. Firefighters who have never been in a real burning building? Whose fault is it that these individuals are performing poorly? Clearly, the culpability would lie with the trainers and the administrators who had not given them that important state-of-the-art training resource. Likewise, if there are law enforcement officers confronting life and death shooting situations and responding inappropriately, whose fault is that? Whose fault is it when there are readily available state-of-the-art resources that prepare and inoculate officers for deadly force encounters, but the resources have not been provided? Again, it is clearly the trainers and administrators who failed to provide them with the resources to do their jobs as best they can. It appears that force-on-force paint bullet training is exactly such a resource. It is to the police officer and the soldier exactly what the flame house is to the firefighter. What should be done with officers who do not want to participate in paint bullet training for fear of looking bad or simply because the rounds hurt a little? Say you are an administrator in a fire bureau and you have a firefighter who refuses to go in a burning house in a training exercise. You have trained him well up to this point. You have counseled him about his refusal. You have worked with him, but still he refuses to go in. As the administrator, what would you do with him? You would fire him. The firefighter has given you prima facie de facto evidence that he is not qualified to carry a hose into a burning building. Such a person is not an inferior human being. He may in fact be a superior human being. He is just not qualified to carry a hose into a burning building, and you would be morally and legally liable if you permitted him to continue in that job. If a law enforcement officer refuses to engage in paint bullet training after you have counseled him, trained him, and worked with him in every way, what would you do if you were his captain? Again, he has given you prima facie de facto evidence that he is not qualified to go into a real gunfight. He is not even qualified to carry a weapon. Should he run into a deadly force situation and fail to perform appropriately, you, as the administrator, your agency, and your city will go down hard in court. Warriors have a moral obligation to protect society and its citizens. Individuals who refuse to participate in realistic training should not be in the business. Memory distortions. 1,000 fantasies begin to throng into my memory. John Milton, Comus. According to Dr. Artwall's research, 21% of police officers involved in shootings experienced memory distortions. In other words, more than 1 in 5 officers in a gunfight remembered something that did not happen. Here is a classic example told by Dr. Artwell. 2 police officers are in a gunfight, blazing away at the suspect. One said later that he saw his partner get shot. "I saw the bullets rip through my partner's body," he said. "I saw the blood gush out. I drop, kill the suspect, holster my weapon, and turn to my partner. But he's fine. He's not hit." The officer clearly saw his partner shot. He saw the bullet holes, and he saw the blood. When the battle was over, he goes to his partner's aid, but discovers he is not hurt at all. The officer believes what he saw with such intensity that he begins pulling at his partner's clothes, which understandably distresses the unharmed man. When under great stress, you may envision your worst fear. "My God, my partner was hit." And you see it so clearly in your mind that you are absolutely convinced it really happened. Sometimes people remember what actually happened and what they envisioned as happening, creating what one combat veteran referred to as a parallel worlds effect. Children are not usually good witnesses, so great caution must be exercised when there is no other choice but to use them. Until a child is about 9 years old, he is incredibly malleable and suggestible. There is only a small difference between his fantasy world and his real world. Is it so hard to believe that the mind of a frightened adult might, under great stress, be just as malleable as a child's? I had the opportunity to train Canadian soldiers shortly after they returned from a peacekeeping operation. One of the medics asked me, "Colonel, why do the wounded usually hallucinate? And why do they always hallucinate the most horrible things? They say things like, 'I let my buddies down. I failed. My legs are gone. I'm paralyzed. I'm never going to have babies. All my buddies are dead. I'm a coward.' Why do they always hallucinate such bad things?" In life and death combat situations, people often envision possibilities, and sometimes those possibilities become reality in their minds. And seldom do they envision positive things occurring when people are trying to kill them and friends are dying. Jill Watt is a remarkably perceptive observer who conducted extensive investigations among the survivors of a small battle to capture Villa Punta just days before the end of World War II. In her research, she found that it soon became apparent that very often a whole incident, a place, would be blanked from someone's memory if they believed themselves guilty of causing a comrade's death or letting their unit down. Most often, they proved not to be at fault at all. But the effect was so powerful that, out of a small unit, 2 had even taken up lifetime whodunit careers, one becoming a judge, another a senior police officer, without ever running their own seminal events to ground. I was allowed to examine debriefing reports of the battle and found that only one man had been alert enough to say, "At this point, my memory of the action went blank. I do not remember anything that happened next until about an hour later." But all the others believed they had remembered every detail, even though blanking a whole floor of the villa, whole rooms from their accounts. In one particularly striking case, a tough, reliable old Scottish Batman, a personal servant or orderly to an officer, who had faithfully served the young officer whose death I was investigating, said that the boy had been pinned under falling masonry, his stomach completely torn away. "We couldn't tell his mother that," he said. "It was too terrible, but we couldn't move him. We'd never have left him behind otherwise. But the German doctor who cared for the injured officer, till his eventual death, said there wasn't a mark on him. He had died as a result of concussion, from the explosion that brought the ceiling down. The Batman obviously sincerely believed he had seen the terrible mortal wounds. I felt he desperately needed a powerful reason to explain to himself how he could ever have left the young officer and run for the boats. Jill Watt, personal correspondence with Colonel Grossman. If hardened soldiers and highly trained police officers are walking away from combat situations, believing something happened that did not, might citizens and suspects also believe with all their heart that something happened that really did not? You bet. I was training and assisting mental health professionals during the aftermath of one major school massacre. One of the psychologists told me about a teacher who was upset because he had not used towels to pack a gunshot victim's wounds. "I failed," he said, in the debriefing the day after the event. One of the other teachers said to him, "But you did use the towels. Don't you remember?" Then he mentioned something else that he felt he should have done. And again, his fellow teachers reassured him, "You did. Don't you remember?" What happened in this case, and has happened to so many others, is that his memory loss linked with his guilt and convinced him that he had failed. Now, if he had not had a debriefing, if he had not been provided with the opportunity to talk with other individuals who had experienced the same event, he would have spent the rest of his life guilt-ridden and convinced that he had failed and was responsible for the death of an innocent person. After a situation like this, who can convince you of what really happened? Certainly not you, since you are already convinced of the delusion. It is up to others who were there with you. In these horrific situations, we all hold each other's lives in our hands after the event. That is what a debriefing is all about, which we will discuss in detail later. The role of videotaping. The truth is not your enemy. But oh, the truth, the many eyes that look on it, the diverse things they see. George Meredith, A Ballad of Fair Ladies in Revolt. Videotaping is the future, and soon every official act by every warrior profession will be recorded through a lens. There are untold thousands of video recorders sold every year, and there are ever more security cameras and media cameras. We are told that in just a few years, we will all be videotaped wherever we go. Even now, when you walk out the door, you must assume you are being videotaped. At public protests, for example, there are now as many video cameras being operated by protesters as there are media people with cameras. The protesters hope to capture the police using excessive force, or they deliberately tape just part of an incident to make the protesters look victimized and the police guilty. Sometimes these videographers do creative editing to make the police look bad and then take the doctored video to the media. If you are a soldier, police officer, firefighter, emergency medical technician, educator, or any other modern warrior, know that your duties are performed in the public eye. While this may bother you, you shouldn't worry too much about it. If you are doing what you're supposed to be doing, the truth is not your enemy. That said, there could be a problem. Videotape cannot record the perceptual distortions addressed in this section. Videotapes don't capture diminished sound. "What do you mean you didn't hear the shots?" the critics and investigators asked. "There it is on the videotape. You must be lying." "The videotape cannot capture tunnel vision." "What do you mean you didn't see him? He's right there in your field of view. You must be lying." "The videotape cannot capture autopilot." "Why did you do that?" they ask. And you tell them to study your training because you did exactly what had been drilled into you. Will they understand the procedure? The videotape does not capture the perseveration effect that is a normal fear-induced response to a deadly threat. nor can the videotape capture memory distortions that are products of perceptual sets and past associations. Wait a minute. First you said this happened. Now you say it didn't. Why did you lie the first time? Since we can expect critics, investigators, juries, and judges to use videotapes to play Monday morning quarterback and to second-guess the actions of warriors in the heat of battle, it is vital that they be informed about what happens to warriors under such incredible stress, and to understand the limitations of videotaping. This is why Dr. Art Wall and Lauren Christensen's book, Deadly Force Encounters, is so important, and why Dr. Dave Klinger's research, which will be addressed next, is so important. This kind of cutting-edge warrior science research serves as a primer to help us understand what is really happening to the poor guys and gals who live in the heart of darkness, immersed in the universal human phobia, combat. Chapter 5, The Klinger Study, A Parallel Study in Perceptual Distortions. Centuries have not changed human nature. Passions, instincts, particularly the most powerful instinct of self-preservation. These things are expressed differently in accordance with the times, the circumstances, the character, and temperament of races. But beneath it all, the same man is to be found. Hardant Dupic, Battle Studies. Having examined and expanded upon Dr. Artwall's research, let us now look at another major study of sensory distortions in combat. This research was conducted by world-class criminologist Dr. Dave Klinger in a project funded by the National Institute of Justice. Dr. Klinger interviewed 113 police officers from 19 law enforcement agencies in 4 states, each of them a survivor of a gunfight. As you will see, he got data similar to Dr. Artwall's, but in greater depth. This study was extraordinarily well-crafted and conducted, and it has established a model for more work in this area. Dr. Klinger has compiled the results of his study and the powerful personal narratives of the individuals he interviewed into a book titled Voices from the Kill Zone, which I highly recommend. A Sample of Combat Memories, A Snowball's Slice of Hell. Remembrance Fallen from Heaven, and Madness Risen from Hell. Algernon Charles Swinburne, Atalanta in Caledon. The Klinger study involved a survey and interviews with law enforcement officers referred to as subjects who were in gunfights and hit their targets. In a process known as snowballing, Dr. Klinger had his initial subjects ask other officers who had shot people in gunfights to contact him, and these individuals were to ask others, and so on. Therefore, all of his interviews were with officers currently working who had shot someone in combat and had volunteered to be interviewed. While this study sets the standard for such research, it is important to identify a few limitations, which Dr. Klinger freely admits. The subjects were officers who hit their targets in a gunfight, with 4 possible exceptions, leaving out officers, the majority, whose shots missed, thus raising these questions. How is the data affected by the absence of those who missed? Did they miss due to higher levels of stress? Are they feeling a higher degree of stress because of perceived failure? The subjects were generally police officers who stayed in law enforcement, leaving out those who left, thus raising these questions. How is the data affected by the absence of those who left the profession? Did they leave due to poor adjustment after their deadly force incidents? Did they leave because of bad shoots? Has the study systematically left out unlawful and inappropriate shootings? Did those who left the supportive environment of the law enforcement community have greater trouble adjusting, as is generally the case with Vietnam vets who left the military versus those who stayed in? The subjects were willing to be surveyed and interviewed, which may have caused some self-selection bias, as opposed to, say, Dr. Artwall's study, which obtained information from every officer who shot immediately after the event and regardless of whether the officer had hit. Dr. Klinger's study may have left out those unwilling to discuss their shootings. How is the data affected by the